you still got the COVIDs, as we can tell.
Yeah.
Soon here. You're looking robust, I gotta say, for someone with the plague. I've seen worse. Jenna is slowly going through the apotheosis to become a swamp hag. I woke up with her this morning doing a neti pot, just streaming mucus. She sounds like a combination of Fran Drescher meets Patty and Selma Bouvier from The Simpsons. So it's really weird living with a woman who sounds like a New York Jew, that's Greek, that looks like a Palestinian, that's leaking mucus out of her face. It's been a really exciting week so far because I got my booster too, so I felt like shit. So I think we're all basically just slowly dying at this point. It could be worse, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm on a week now of officially having COVID, and I'm probably feeling better. It was definitely some worse days, but I'm okay now ish, and I got to treat myself by sitting home and watching movies and TV shows and whatnot because I was too tired to even play Halo. That's right.
Oh my god, this is really serious then.
Yeah, I barely got to play Halo. It was really depressing. But yeah, I caught up on some stuff. I finally watched the newest season of The Witcher. What else did I do? I watched The Last Duel, which I recommend and was very good. And of course,
is it worth it for blonde Affleck? Because I keep seeing the poster for it, and I keep seeing blonde Ben Affleck, and I just in my head, I just think like, ah, oh, fuck, he's on a bender again. He's dying his hair blonde.
Blonde Affleck is very powerful, but it's not quite as powerful as neckbeard mullet Matt Damon. but the hardest thing about watching The Last Duel is, of course, you have it is mildly distracting that everyone looks so bad, you know, between blonde Affleck, mullet Damon, and normal Adam Driver. But that's the hardest thing. That's the hardest suspension of disbelief, is everyone in the movie is talking about how, like, attractive and charming Adam Driver is. And then you just have to, like, look at him. And then you look at him, and you're like, what the fuck are you talking about? It's even worse than the Pete Davidson thing, because at least the Pete Davidson, like, he's kind of like, he looks like he washes and shit. Like, he clearly, he wears Balenciaga flip-flops and all that dumb shit that at least has, like, the trappings of wealth. Adam Driver, like, consistently looks like he's wearing a shirt that he came in. I don't understand the attraction.
I mean, everybody loves Kyle Len. So, you know.
Do you say why not? Kyle Len?
Kyle Len. I don't want to say it just in case the mouse is listening, because I know you're not really supposed to critique, Herr Mickle Mouse anymore. very, very terrified of, you know, getting a copyright slam if we use the actual character names.
It's fair use. It's parody.
It is parody. Yeah, it's something. I'm going to watch it. I made an attempt to watch the new Matrix movie after watching the original trilogy during my sickness time.
Uh-huh.
And come to the conclusion that the Matrix is one of the worst trilogies ever put together. World building is terrible in that movie. Absolutely fucking awful. I got about 30 minutes into the new Matrix movie, which is like 2.5 hours long, I'm realizing. Mm-hmm. And I just had to take a break because it's too weird about Keanu Reeves being a developer that works for, like, there's like this internal tension that I think Lana is really mad at Warner Brothers for some reason. So it's like this weird subplot with Neo's character that he's got to make a new game because Warner Brothers demands it. And I just can't get into the movie because I can't stop laughing at how stupid that premise is. So I'm trying really desperately to finish that movie, but I cannot. I'm like doing like 15-minute like blocks of it, and I just cannot do it.
It just doesn't look interesting to me at all. Like it just doesn't look like an interesting movie. I just don't care about it whatsoever. The original Matrix was fun, cool, and then the second one was bad. The third one
it's really, really bad. Yeah. Like, on watching it again as a person with slightly better opinions than I had in high school.
You had bad opinions in high school? I can't see that at all.
I know it's really hard to believe. I think I still got some bad opinions now even, but I think they're so few and far between we don't notice them. I used to think The Matrix was cool, but now it's basically just like propaganda for like the alt-right and like Coinbase bros and stuff, like crypto bros are like, dude, take the blue pill and invest in Ethereum or something. You know, it's really weird how it's gotten like taken by that weird subset of people that makes it somehow makes everything attached to it worse now.
Yeah. Now, answer me something quick before we move on. You are slightly older than me. So were you like a Dylan Klebold style guy in high school? Did you have like the Morpheus leather jacket, Marilyn Manson? Like, were you popping off in that regard?
I wasn't as mall goth as that. I did not have a trench coat. I had an army jacket, which I think is probably cooler, but also probably implies a lot worse by wearing that. No, I was like a weird punk metalhead with a mohawk that wore an army jacket and combat boots, and I'd walk through my very, very African-American Hispanic school of people going, "School shooter, school shooter!" So high school was great for me because nobody bothered me. It was super fun. Definitely didn't do the Morpheus sunglasses, though. I did have a friend that had the trench coat, and he was just a tall, really like overly skinny dude in a trench coat, and it's just, it looked less like he was going to shoot up to school and more like he was going to expose himself, so it didn't really work. Not my vibe. I like to hang out at the mall still, just hang out, like, you know, movie stores and stand there for Mohawk and be like, hey, I'm cool. And I was not cool. So that's about the extent of my high school years, that and watching a lot of movies. No guns besides BB guns, though. I didn't bring them to school because we had metal detectors and sometimes strip searches. By strip searches, like empty your pockets, not like hands against the wall, don't clench kind of thing. But
they weren't strip searches, Scott. Just because the vice principal took you in his office and you immediately pulled your pants off doesn't mean anyone asked.
That's what I, every time I got sent to the principal, like, dude, take your pants off. Let's talk about this. And I don't know. I'm not in charge now. I'm starting to learn, though, and as I look into grad school, that you're actually not supposed to do that. So it's going to be interesting, I guess, when I enter my teaching career one of these days. That's probably really bad, right? Me, a podcast guy, admitting to becoming a teacher. What could possibly go wrong with that if they find this when I'm interviewing for a job at a prestigious institution of education for young men and women?
Hey, to be fair, if we figured out the ratio, I definitely talk about pedophiles more than you do, so you're probably good.
Just want to say it right now, if you're a future employer listening, not a fan of pedos. I want all the kids to keep their pants on.
But they are real, and they need to be talked about.
They do need to be talked about.
And I think there needs to be awareness about them and what they stand for and why, you know what, you should welcome them into your home. No.
You know.
Parody.
We don't want pedos in your home unless you choose to do that, in which case, kind of judging you a little bit.
Speaking of pedophiles, should we talk about this movie that's about the U.S. government, essentially?
I feel like this movie is really on the nose, and in full disclosure, I've never actually seen this one, so this was a first watch
for
me.
Yeah, this is a first for me as well. I had heard of it very briefly. Only knew about it because I know that it was this director's first film. And that's the only reason why it was kind of like in my head. What's the movie, Scott?
So we have Short Night of Glass Dolls, or La Corta Notte della Bambole di Vetro, for those that want to hear me butcher the Italian language. You know, it is a 1971 giallo by Aldo Lado. I have a little opening I'll do when we pop the episode in. It's pretty interesting. set in communist Prague, Czechoslovakia. So something there for Steve. There's a lot of political implications in this movie. I, for one, really enjoyed it. There is going to be an interesting little way the story's told that we'll get into. And like any good giallo, it's a giallo not set in Italy. So it's going to be pretty interesting, I think. And again, we don't have Jenna, so it's just two men talking about Italian film. It's the second of the gialli that we're going to cover. Steve's picking the final one for next week. And then I don't know what we're going to do for February. Something with, I guess, tits and blood and werewolves or something. So we'll figure that out.
I do like the idea of having themes. Maybe that's something we do for the new year. But I'll announce it now at the top of the episode so that Scott's mind will dance and grow a light, and anyone who decides that they don't want to hear about this weird movie but want to tune back in next week can. The movie that we're going to cover next week is the notorious film. Do you have any guesses what I'm going to say, Scott?
This is going to be Salo, isn't it?
No, it is not. Okay. It's not a giallo. It's, I don't count Salo, so we won't cover that in this regard. No,
I was really thinking you were going to pull either a Bava out your ass or find a way to get Pasolini involved. So that was where my
Bava was a good shout, but no, I'm gonna be going with the New York Ripper.
Yeah,
One of the most notorious films to come out of that whole giallo scene, and a later one too, being into the 80s, where you start to get this mix of the pure exploitation style film and giallo. So and there's a lots of stuff about it that's just extremely stupid.
This will be fun. I'm hoping Jenna's better next week for this, because I really am going to be excited to see if she can even get through this whole movie. This is going to be good.
Yeah. It's an interesting film. I watched it once in my edgy high school days, and so I am very excited to go back and revisit it as an adult with mostly fresh eyes. But as I've been working through some of Fulci's catalog, this one, I keep thinking about it. It keeps existing in my mind. So I've had this in the chamber since we decided that we were going to do a Giallo January. So, yeah, next week is New York Ripper.
Yeah, it's going to be a good one. All right, cool. All right, we'll do the fucking commercial like usual, and then we'll jump on into Short Night of Glass Dolls. All right, Short Night of Glass Dolls, or as is known by its original Italian title that I'll once again butcher for everybody, La Corte Notte delle Bambole di Vetro, is a more traditional... I know.
La Corte Notte delle Bambole di Vetro.
Yeah, be a show-off. Wow, you can talk Italian better. Cool. Anyway, it's a more traditional giallo in comparison to our first film of the month, which was Suspiria, and that was Jenna's choice once again. But it's not without its own disorienting mystery to unravel. This was released in 1971. It is the directorial debut of Aldo Lotto, which is a really hard name to say fast if you got a speech impediment like I do.
Alan Alda.
It's going to tell the story of American journalist Gregory Moore, which is always fun throughout the whole movie to hear everybody in bad dubbed English go, Gregory Moore, throughout it. He's on international assignment in Prague, Czechoslovakia, as he recalls his current fate, how it occurred, and who is behind it. Shot through the reminiscence of his conscious mind within his corpse, the audience is taken through a bewildering journey to determine the powers that be behind the disappearance of his girlfriend, Mira Svoboda, and the elites pulling the strings surreptitiously, all the while Gregory desperately attempts to contact the living around him. It manages to be an example of traditional genre archetypes for giallo, while also maintaining some solid pacing and acting, despite an amusingly poor dub, at least in the version that I watched, which was on Shudder.
Yeah, not a good one.
It's not a good version of the film. Obviously, with any giallo, I don't know if we went over this when I did the first episode of Jenna, you can get it not dubbed, and you can deal with reading subtitles like a grown-ass adult. I obviously do it. If you want to have a more entertaining time, find one like the versions that are on Shudder that are dubbed. They do make a more serious movie more comical. Short Night of Glass Dolls is, in my opinion, it's a super excellent introduction to the genre that is as claustrophobic as it is a political thriller. I don't know if this would technically fall under the polizioteshi, that another word that Steve's going to correct me on right now.
Oh. So a couple things there. Yeah. One, in Italian, you don't do that she sound. So it's polizioteschi.
I just know how to swear. That's the only thing as I took from being a kid hearing it, was just the swear words.
Polizioteschi. A singular would, of course, be poliziotesco.
Polizio Joe Pesci.
No, because it's the poliziotesco films are generally, they deal with that whole socio-political kind of shit. It's generally specifically to Italy and crime. So it has to be like mostly in Italy and be about crime more so than like the political stuff.
Okay, that's good to know, because I'm doing What Have You Done to Solange, which is one of my favorite of these movies. But I've read some reviews that say it is, but it doesn't fit then by that definition because it is set in England. So I'm trying to still navigate that genre classification, because everybody loves the six-letter word that is giallo.
Yeah,
it's everyone's favorite like word right now. But I want to make sure that I don't put it into the wrong category like that, because I think at least with the difference between Short Night of Glass Dolls and What Have You Done to Solange, there's no supernatural elements in What Have You Done to Solange. Mm-hmm. It's more of a legitimate mystery,
right?
With violent crime, whereas this does have a black magic backdrop that's kind of thrown in.
Right. I mean, that's part of the strange Dunning-Kruger effect that we often see with horror, is a lot of people that have a cursory understanding of it, not to exalt ourselves, but obviously we have more experience than the layman. But people that have a kind of rudimentary grasp will start throwing genres around, and, you get that kind of person that thinks like anything that's Italian is a giallo, which, you know, it isn't true. And you have plenty of films that are even horror films by Italian directors of that time period that, like, you know, our director next week, Lucio Fulci, the film that we'll be covering, New York Ripper, it is a giallo film, but Fulci made actually not a huge amount of giallo films and isn't really regarded for his giallo films. Like,
I mean, he's way more known just for straight up horror, and he just happens to be Italian. So.
Exactly, but it's you know, like, oh, this is his. You know, he's a giallo guy, but it's like a Lizard in Woman's Skin is probably like his, and like Don't Torture a Duckling, but like Zombie 2 is like what he's like really known. One of the things he's really known for, of course, is like the zombie movies, and shit. So it's like it's one of those weird things where he's attached to this like concept, but he's made a few of those movies, but, you know, The Beyond, House by the Cemetery, these aren't giallo films at all. But it's attached, yeah, it's hardly attached to that. And so we have an interesting thing with this movie specifically that we're covering today, where it, in the most bare bones of terms, fits that giallo category, which is mystery fiction thriller, essentially. It then became this thing that was known for the black gloved killers and the crazy colors and everything. But really a lot of that is like the colors and stuff. That was people really mostly starting to just ape Argento. specifically. Like,
yeah,
you know, it's not that it's not a part of the genre, but when you think of that, it's because you think of Suspiria and Inferno and Profondo Rosso and shit. But it's like, yeah, you're thinking of one guy. Like, and it's not to detract, because obviously he's huge in that, but there are tons of Jolly, and part of that is because of the way that it was, what it stemmed from, as we went over in our editor / Jalo episode, as I'm sure you touched on last week. I didn't listen to that shit. I edited it in the morning while I had COVID. I didn't listen to that shit. I just waited for it to go through. I'm like, is there too much space between these waveforms? That's all I did. But
thank you for participating in the show while sick. I appreciate it.
That was the most I could muster. But as I'm sure you probably did a great job of explaining, is the whole term comes from like this disposable, like, pulp magazine with like cheap chintzy like throwaway thriller plots. And so this film genre kind of came out of that, coming back into prevalence post fascism in Italy. So there's just a bunch of crazy shit, and so some of the stuff will have like these horror elements, but there are a lot of Jolly that are purely like mystery thrillers. It might have murders and stuff, but it's not all about these like weird kills or like psychosexual stuff. A lot of them are movies like this, that this one is weird, but if you were to look at a bunch of the Jolly that no one remembers, which is an important thing to say, because there are thousands of these films.
Oh yeah,
if you look at a lot of the ones that people don't remember, there are a lot more like this than there are like a Suspiria or like a Bird with the Crystal Plumage or whatever. Like, there's a lot more films that are similar to Short Night of Glass Dolls that have a little bit of political intrigue, have a lot of this kind of open, of slower burn pacing. And not a lot of that crazy color and everything that people are anticipate, or the prog rock score. You'll have like traditional scores from a guy who's, of course, a master, like Ennio Morricone. And so I don't want to seem like I'm harping on this particularly, but I think that whole like connection to like, oh, is this a Poliziotteschi and whatever? It's like, no. But that's part of the thing, is people will say this is a giallo, and then they'll get disappointed when they watch it, and it's not exactly like Suspiria.
Yeah, like, I did the fifth chord for the Mutant Fam, and, like, the one thing I pointed out is, like, in that movie, there's color through all these movies, but they're not that Technicolor saturated,
right?
Like, depth. Like, the fifth chord is washed out and cold and dirty. It feels like a movie where you're following a guy trying to solve a crime, like a what all these movies stem from in a long ways, which is like film noir.
Right.
Exactly. So when you get a movie like this, yeah, I think people enjoy saying giallo, and then they look at a movie like this, and then they're really confused because, you know, there's only this one or two, you know, little pathways, you know, that they think of, like, you know, you just said. Which is weird too, because of this whole giallo conversation, it's like everybody wants everything to be this now. I know the new Scream movie came out, which we've, I think, just politely ignored covering.
Yeah, I mean, who cares?
Yeah, my new favorite discussion on Twitter film discourse is Scream giallo, and why it is. And it's not everything has to fit in the cool 6-letter words box to be an entertaining movie to you. So it's really weird. I think it's going to be really weird, I should say, when we cover this, if you're not super familiar with the genre and you watch this, it's going to be completely different than what the conversation seems to just always hover around.
Yeah, it definitely fits that genre, but it doesn't fit what the warping of public perception of that genre is. It doesn't fit that, like, yeah, if you're someone who's like still firmly in the Malignant is a giallo film boat, even though I've come around to liking that movie, it's still not a giallo. If you're someone who thinks that this argument that Scream is a giallo has any sort of merit whatsoever. And like, yeah, your only experience with Giallo is these big classics that are by Argento, or something even weirder, like one of the myriad kind of indie art house attempts to make quote unquote modern giallo style films, like We're Still Here, which takes a divergence from that, and films that are straight giallo, attempting to be straight modern giallo, like Strange Color of Your Body's Tears, which are taking bits and pieces of films from that time and putting them together. You're gonna be like, what? Now, to be clear, that being said, personally, and we'll talk about this as I go through, but to be honest, personally, I found this movie pretty boring. I find a lot of things about it extremely interesting. And to me, I think that this is one of those movies that sounds way cooler on paper, whether you're talking about it, whether you're writing a synopsis, or whether you're reading the screenplay. It's way cooler on paper than it actually ended up being in practice. And part of that is definitely into the it not having enough of those vibes. As much as I'm saying it still fits the thing and blah, 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 it, besides like having very rich blacks and stuff in the cinematography to kind of give everything this very like Italian chiaroscuro kind of feel, besides that, which I found visually interesting, and like the main thrusts of the story and everything, a lot of it I did feel lacks the style of giallo. And not, again, not this kind of preconceived version of giallo, but the actual style that giallo was known to have. I think a lot of that is missing in this, and so I was kind of bored overall. But that's my little
fair.
That's my little spiel at the disclaimer. Beginning as we're going forward. Yeah,
I did enjoy this one, but we'll share the opinions as we get more into this. Let's talk about our director. Our director is Aldo Lado, who was actually still is. He is still alive. An Italian writer and director whose career, while shorter than many others in the genre, has several strong productions, including this week's film, 1972's Who Saw Her Die, which is considered a pretty well-known giallo, and 1975's Last Stop on the Night Train. Lado utilized several different European cities to act as backdrops across his films, including this film, which views Italy, Yugoslavia, and parts of East Germany. And he was assisted in the writing of this film with some help from Rüdiger von Spies, a German, and Ernesto Gastaldi. Now, Rüdiger basically just helped write some dialogue in terms of what he's done. He was basically just a small-time writer, nothing really fancy besides that. Now, Ernesto Gastaldi is a little bit different. This duel that did assist Lado, Ernesto Gastaldi is probably the more prominent of the names involved. He's considered by many to be the godfather of Italian horror and sci-fi from Italy. He wrote numerous scripts for gialli and spy thrillers, including the very well-done Umberto Lenzi classic, So Sweet, So Perverse, which is on Shudder if you want to watch that one, as well as celebrated contributor to giallo Sergio Martino on several of his films, such as All the Colors of the Dark and the semi-softcore and most likely misogynistic but very entertaining Torso. So Ernesto Gastaldi like actually brought some level of experience to Aldo Lado, who's just a guy who finally decided to become a director. So it's an interesting combination of people that we're going to see get involved in this movie with a guy that's never done anything before.
And Gastaldi was one of the screenwriters of one of my favorite named actual, undeniably Poliziotteschi films, The Cynic, The Rat, and The Fist. Which I did.
That's such a good name.
Yeah, which I did see when I was younger. It was in one of those like multi-packs or whatever, I think. And it was not good. But there was a guy in the movie named Luigi, and he was nicknamed the Chinaman. And that was very funny. That was very funny to me as a child.
I want to talk about one character before we get into the cast of this movie that I could not find credited, and who is the creepiest character, and he appears for legitimately like 30 seconds in the film, and it's the fucking guy in the suit that's got no legs that's wheeling himself around on like a hand cart. The minute he shows up, Jenna's like, please tell me he's the killer, because that is the creepiest man I've ever seen in my life. He just appears, looks at the guy that finds the main character's body, and just smokes a cigarette and stares at him, and then we never see this legless man ever again. He's one of the funniest characters I've seen in any movie we've covered as a random character.
That is one of the that's one of the things I did enjoy about this movie, was that it did set a lot of your unease and tension by throwing lots of weird, kind of impenetrably strange things that it does not explain. You have this, and then you also have like an extremely large room when we're at the morgue / hospital. There's like an extremely large room that just has a bunch of like fetuses and tumors and random body parts and jars. And that's like all that it is, but it's like they're also like bringing a body through there for some reason. It's stuff like that did make help with some weird visual unease. So yeah, that just reminded me of that. But that's part of the stuff that I did find enjoyable.
Yeah, there's some weird, really interesting set pieces in this that we'll get into. But first, we got to talk about the music. Now, unlike Suspiria and Ennio Argento, like Steve mentioned, we don't have a cool prog rock goblin soundtrack with this. But we do have someone of quite the, I guess, important note. Music in this was done by Ennio Morricone himself, the legendary Italian composer, orchestrator, and conductor. He is, or was, unfortunately, Il Maestro did pass away, multi-award-winning composer. He's scored hundreds of films and television productions and worked alongside numerous celebrated directors of Giallo and beyond, including Argento, Lucio Fulci, Paolo Cavara, Massimo Dallamano. Besides just those guys, he's worked alongside longtime friend and the originator of the spaghetti western, Sergio Leone, who as composer for his films did the soundtracks that help push spaghetti westerns into prominence and popularity. He did everything for the Dollars trilogy, of which The Ecstasy of Gold has become one of, if not his best known composition. Everyone's heard this song. Metallica uses it as an opener for their live show, which is probably, in retrospect, as a kid thinking that's super cool, and now being like, it's kind of an insult to the composer, like really badly.
Yeah.
He's such a fucking amazing composer.
Yeah. And in everything that you could possibly imagine, from completely serious, beloved films to stupid spaghetti westerns to fucking Red Sonja. Literally, yes.
Yeah, I forgot he did Red Sonja.
Literally did Red Sonja.
That movie affected me as a child because I learned that women could in fact carry swords, and it definitely became a kink, and I still think I have.
And even stuff as recently as like The Hateful Eight, which was like 2015 or 16. You know,
such a good movie.
Yeah, great movie. But of course, The Untouchables, everything. He's one of the greatest all time composers, perhaps the greatest all time composer. And I believe he passed last year, actually, or the year
last
before.
Year?
Last year or the year before.
2020. It was recent. That's why I keep. Yeah.
Yeah, 2020.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really find anybody who doesn't have this type of resume and not hold them to just an incredible. Like, this is at the point where it's like, you know, for me, he's up there with Scorsese. It's just an untouchable contributor to film and television, just far everything he's done.
And that's one of the things to be noted too, where he elevated this film for me. It wasn't, and it's one of those things where once you know, and you put on a movie that you've never seen before, or maybe you've heard a little bit about or whatever, and you see, you know, score, music, whatever it says by Ennio Morricone, you know it's going to be good, and you know it's going to elevate the piece. I mean, good composers, and I don't mean just good technically, I mean guys that actually have a good understanding of what the score is supposed to be doing for a film, you'll see the places that they take it and the way that you'll have specific qualities throughout. I mean, this film has like, I don't know, it has like an airy, almost kind of ethereal quality. This kind of very,
it's like an
mystical,
unnerving,
like,
lullaby.
Yeah, it has this kind of. It's not like, it doesn't ratchet up the tension with like the kind of score you would hear in like a Vincent Price movie or whatever. It's not like dragging you along and telling you this is how you should feel. It's instead giving you a blueprint for how to feel. It's inciting you to feel certain things. In this movie, it acts less as a cue like you would in, if you listen to a normal horror movie, you might hear that like dun dun kind of bullshit, you know, the shutter opening sound.
Yeah.
You'll hear something like that, and that's not making you feel a certain way, that's telling you to feel a certain way. When you have a movie less with a score like this, that score is kind of helping you along to get lured in and feel a certain way.
Yeah, and it does do that giallo thing where it does kind of take that same theme, and it does play it throughout the film, maybe in slightly different compositions, but this main theme is like I said, it's a lullaby to me, and it does kind of calm you to the things that are happening, but it's also incredibly eerie. It's just, yeah. It really does, I set the tone for this movie, and I actually 100% agree with you. I know you didn't like this as much as I did, but it really does make this movie so much better throughout the entirety of how it goes through. Now, in terms of cinematography, we got another interesting character joining Aldolato here. Longtime Italian cinematographer Giuseppe Ruzzolini, who has worked on numerous productions in and outside Italy, but is probably best known to American audiences for his work behind the camera on Sergio Leone's Duck, You Sucker, and the 1984 adaptation of Stephen King's Firestarter with Drew Barrymore, as well as several of Pier Paolo Pasolini's productions.
And I put
in the note Pasolini. I was like, God, I hope he doesn't pick a Pasolini for us to do, because I really do need to revisit a lot of his films, but like he did the Canterbury Tales for him when Pasolini did, you know, these erotic medieval tales, you know, that. And I think he may have done the Decameron as well. Don't quote me on that. But because of this history working alongside Pasolini, as well as other more artistic-minded directors, he kind of found himself more often than not at odds with Aldolato, finding his direction and overall filmmaking skill to be laughable and something he would reiterate often to the director during filming. These guys did not get along at all. And I think this is probably a wake-up call for Aldolato, because like, yeah, Ennio Morricone is doing my music, but the whole time he's filming, there's just this incredibly artistic cinematographer just telling him he's a fucking moron the whole time.
Yeah.
Like, what do you mean you want to put lilies on her while she's laying in a music place? This is stupid. You fucking suck.
Yeah, it's not quite it's not quite some of these guys' like most prestigious film that they've done, which makes it all the more interesting. And that's also just the way that things used to work then, and it's kind of funny you see the comparison now, right? Because we would kind of laugh at something like this modern day. It's like we did when we talked about our in our Candyman review or whatever, and it's like, look at this fucking like random person, they made like one cool short film, and now their first movie ever, they're getting like this massive budget and they're getting Ennio Morricone to do the score and shit. But back then, it's just that's the way that the you know, things would just get churned out and they just send stuff to Morricone and be like, here, fucking make it, make a song. who do we got available to shoot this fucking thing?
Yeah, I mean, especially during this time, not like there wasn't Italian horror, but it was kind of like something as someone that worked in film, you didn't really actively, I guess, look for. And again, this is another guy with, you know, a similar pedigree to Ennio Morricone, but the other side of the coin, where it's just like, yeah, I guess a job's a job. in terms of the cast, in terms of any other production notes, I couldn't find anything with this film that was particularly interesting or, oh, I can't believe this happened. I mean, in terms of practical effects, there's none that are needed. It really is a film that is set by the tone of the music and the acting and the camera work and really not too much else. The cast is a very, very talented cast, although it will probably have a lot of names you're not used to if this is not the type of films you watch often. We have Jean Sorel as Gregory Moore, our protagonist, born Jean-Bernard de Chus de Combal de Roquebrune. That is the worst French I could have possibly done. Definitely offended that whole country. That's Jean Sorel's real name. The longtime French actor that has worked considerably in European cinema for over 50 years. He plays our living dead protagonist as he desperately tries to reawaken as he slowly puts together his fate and that of his girlfriend. First thing, Jean Sorel in this movie, A+ for me, great mustache. There's nothing better than a film with a lead that has a great mustache.
Yeah.
Big fan of it just right there.
He's a hot guy. He's got a cool mustache. That's basically my entire feelings on him and his
character. He's fairly Franco Nero-esque looking, where you might confuse him because he's got those big blue, beautiful eyes. But I'm not going to pretend I am super familiar with like Jean Sorel outside of basically giallo and crime films.
That's what people would know him for in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, that's about it. I mean, he had a huge career in France for like television stuff and some film, but nothing I honestly know about, but I did enjoy him in this for the most part. Joining him is Ingrid Thulin as Jessica, who is a name you might recognize, if you're a film person. She is a celebrated Swedish actress who was known for her partnership with fellow countryman and director Ingmar Bergman. She plays Jessica, another journalist and former lover of Gregory, who, despite her lingering feelings, assists him in finding Mira. She's essentially the hot cougar in this film with a filmography that again does not belong in a guy's first ever debut film.
No, crazy.
I mean, she's done a huge amount of Ingmar Bergman films, which if you've never seen Ingmar Bergman another director that is absolutely fantastic with damn near everything he's done. Yes. You know, The Seventh Seal, everybody knows of, very deeply emotional and existential films that are just, if you're gonna take a film class in college, you're probably gonna see Ingmar Bergman,
that's for sure.
Joining the cast is Mario Adorf as Jack, although his name technically is Jacques, at least in the version of the dub, they call him Jack. That is from veteran German Italian character actor of film and television Mario Adorf. He is Jack, another journalist and communist that works alongside Gregory and Jessica in Prague with a penchant for sardonic humor, misogyny, and heavy drinking. He is my favorite character in the movie because he's just a complete fucking scumbag and it's hysterical.
Yeah.
My favorite scene of him in this movie is when they're at the party with all the socialites and he's there with his American girlfriend that's... whose father's rich, and he's just, I don't know if they ever explain it in the non-dub version, but I'm assuming she's supposed to be just stoned out of her mind, and he's just like, hey, Greg, look at my girlfriend, and he's just straight up, like, grabbing her tit, and like, very firm, yeah, these American girls love the bed of communists, and he's just the funniest fucking character throughout the entire movie, and he's always drinking.
Yeah.
We have Barbara Bach as Mira Svoboda, American actress and model, best known for her longtime marriage to former Beatles drummer Ringo Starr, and definitely not for anything of value she's actually ever done. Come on now. she is Mira Svoboda, the dreamlike lover of Gregory, whose beauty and childlike demeanor makes her the target of a conspiracy that Gregory and company are desperate to solve. She's got that, I think, late 60s, early 70s it girl look. You know, skinny girl, long hair, big eyes. She's not a character as much as a plot device. I mean, her whole shtick is that she's in love with Gregory, and she gives him a gift of, pinned up butterflies. That's about the extent of her plot to the film, besides being gone.
Yeah, and that's part of one of my the several interesting things that I found within this movie that I enjoyed as like a concept, less so when the actual experience of viewing the movie. So we'll get into that in a sec.
Yeah, and then kind of rounding out the cast, two very lesser known actors, but important to talk about as characters. Where we got Jose Quaglio as Velinsky, who is an Italian actor and theater director of both comedies and dramas. He plays the mysterious Velinsky, an upper-class socialite, supporter of the arts, and chamber music aficionado with a powerful secret. And then rounding out the cast is Fabian Savajevic as Professor Karting, longtime Croatian actor, and as a Croat, of me, obviously, butchering another countryman's name besides the Italian names, pulls this full circle. Obviously, I can offend everybody with my horrible pronunciation. He portrays the scientist Professor Karting, who enjoys stabbing tomatoes to prove they feel pain throughout one scene of the movie, which is not at all accurate at all, but adds to another interesting point that gets touched upon in the movie. I don't even know where to begin, but this is definitely an interesting film because the backdrop of Czechoslovakia at the time kind of becomes this important reasoning behind kind of the things that are happening and a lot of the stuff that is said. It's set during or right after the Prague Spring, which I'm not going to pretend I remember a whole lot from my college classes, but was basically the Czechoslovakia tried to open up a little bit more, get a little bit more less censored, and it didn't really work out. So there was kind of a time of revolution, but it kind of remained a communist state while the Soviet Union was still alive and thriving up until, you know, the late 80s. So it does kind of have this, if you don't know what's happening, you're not missing anything out, but it's going to make a lot more sense why there is, for instance, a very imposing communist commissar that's in charge of this case that's also pursuing Gregory, thinking he's the killer, kind of thing that is a little bit more impactful if you know that history, I guess.
Yeah, so to do a little background on it, not because it's not really super relevant to the plot at all of the film, you know, it doesn't really dig into that, but it does help to set up a lot of the themes that we see in the film and some of the stuff that I do find interesting about it. So the Prague Spring specifically was a period that was early January 1968 that ended in about almost end of August. Let me just look it up. January 5th, 1968 to August 21st, 1968. So about 7.5 months. And what this was after the election of the first secretary of the Communist Party, right? You have a single party system because it's communist. Alexander Dubček, he was elected, and he was a bit of a reformist. He was still a, to keep in mind, because this is part of a thing that's also misunderstood about this period a lot, this guy was a communist. He was a Communist Party official for his whole life, basically. And what he was attempting to do was loosen some censorship restrictions, like Scott said. He wanted to partially decentralize the economy, and to democratize a bit more so that there were open elections, allowed more freedom of travel. And one of the things that he also did was to separate the country into a three-state federation. And so what happened after this point was that once all this started happening, the Warsaw Pact countries invaded Czechoslovakia to quell this and put an end to this. And they thought that they were going to be able to take the country and stop this rebellion as they saw it in 4 days. And this ended up being months of rebellion until it was finally done away with. And then the only real reform that was left after all of this was the separation of the country into states. But they didn't keep the three that were there. They only separated it into Czechia and Slovakia, which then became the basis of once communism was over and the country dissolved after the Velvet Revolution, that you then get the two separate nations of Czech Republic and Slovakia. So why is this important? What's going on? Why am I rambling? Well, there's a couple things here, right? There's still that Western conception of communism going on in this film. Now, the Prague Spring itself was viewed by a lot of people outside of Eastern Bloc nations as not what it was, which is like internecine communist policies being argued and then war being fought over it because of how that looked, because much of the Warsaw Pact nations that were quote unquote communist were more so closer to totalitarian dictatorships than true communist parties. We can argue about this time and time again, but a truly communist system wouldn't have
trying so hard not to just throw out really stupid comments to incense you, but I don't want just to turn it into a political podcast, but
yeah, we can go into this.
Steve is not inaccurate, coming from someone that disagrees with him politically on a lot of things. He is not inaccurate of the things in the way he's describing these things. They're actually, this is, I would say, a textbook way to explain it.
Right. So I'm trying to be as unbiased as possible when actually explaining what's going on here. So what a lot of this ends up being, and you have some tastes of that in the film itself, such as the dealing with press. You know, I mean, obviously it's a classic giallo trope of having journalists, but having journalists involved in this thing that was very misrepresented within the Eastern Bloc and within the West, right? Because within the West, this was kind of used as an example of communist suppression. Dubček literally called this socialism with a human face. It was supposed to be kind of bringing out and taking away the totalitarian leanings of Stalinism as a, you know, reworking of Leninism, which in of itself is a reworking of Marxism, kind of taking away some of that more subjugative aspects of that, to be not too dissimilar from what we kind of see in countries today that have like a Nordic model or of social welfare, but with a little bit more, with more regimented control of corporations and stuff, that there's kind of leaning into something more like that. So really not doing any, it's still a socialist framework was who was being suppressed. And the West looks at this as a suppression of democracy, a fledgling democracy, which it partially is, but it's still, again, internal. So it's socialist on socialist violence, essentially. It's pink.
So if you're into that, you're going to love the background to this whole movie.
It's pink. Yeah, it's pink on pink violence. So it's or red on red, whatever you want to call it. So that's what this setup is essentially. And it's these greater, more powerful countries that have really want to keep their power, less so about the socialist ideals, but it's about personal power that is suppressing them. And that's what we essentially get as the main driver of this film. Spoiler alert, you know, there is no real killer. The killers are this Club 99, which is this, you know,
Club 99 Luftballoons. Like, they're just a weird group of corpse-like old socialites. I think Gregory describes them when he's talking to people at this party as bankers, actors, musicians, queers, all of the people you want to know.
Right. It's your classic
Hollywood.
it's what we would call nowadays, in the days of QAnon, it's your deep state, it's your Illuminati, it's, you know, it's the your Moloch worship, it's that kind of concept. And what that is, as we can see current times, something very much so attached to conceptions of the ruling class left by disenfranchised people in the center and the right that are prone to conspiracy theory. So this film itself has this paranoia, but it's attached to, you know, the theories of QAnon is nothing new. It's just packaged as a different type of conspiracy, but the same sort of like deep state kind of, you know, the ruling class is doing this bullshit. It was attached to the Jews at one point. It was attached to Hollywood, attached to both, at, you know, when they're interlinked, attached to the the various royal families of Europe with the, you know, Bilderberg group kind of stuff. It's, you know, even in recent past, it's Eyes Wide Shut, you know, it's that kind of attachment of horrible, you know, disgusting, debaucherous acts onto a large entity that is almost faceless, but at the same time omnipresent and ridiculously powerful. So this film itself has this kind of vibe as commenting on that kind of view of this is what these left-wing socialist communist countries really are. It's not communism, it's
Moloch worship,
right? It's essentially that. And which is why another one of the interesting things that come in this film is directly related to that, and I'm touched on it briefly, is you know, there is a way that you can view a lot of these older giallo movies as being sexist or anti-feminist, and you can view it as such. I understand that, but you know, and having Mira as not really a character, well, or really an interesting person. Something stupid is that Mira, the name in Slavic languages means peace, if I remember correctly. So you essentially have this person who is representative of a concept to this larger entity, right? And the way that this entity is consuming young people, consuming beauty, that's the point. It can be very much so argued that, you know, not to say that Alda Lado was some fucking second wave feminist, but that...
That's Alan Alda. He's a huge feminist.
Huge. Feminism's great. Huge. that's just great. Feminism. You love it. You love to see it. That's, I don't have a great Alda, but it's there. It's a little bit there. But but that's kind of the point of that character even to Gregory, she's barely anything but a
slam piece, essentially.
Right. But not only that, but like, he's this reporter.
He really doesn't seem to care.
Right.
Yeah, it's conceptual because he doesn't really seem to care throughout the movie that she's missing. Like, he's joking around with Jack at a bar at one point and like meeting him out at places while he's solving the crime. And he's not that like broken up that Mira's gone. He's more just like, I got to solve the mystery because I'm a journalist.
Right. Like, and so there's a lot of symbolism there. There's that indifference of journalism. And in, you know, the propagandist kind of way that it goes about it, you have his ineffectualness by being paralyzed and whatnot, his complete loss of power within the system. So there is a lot of symbolism and a lot of interesting stuff when you break out and break down parts of the movie, and it comes between those kind of political machinations and kind of this playing with of giallo films, right? Giallo as a genre, like a lot of horror genres, very much so just like churns through women, right? The female body is just grist for the mill to get these little perverts rocks off watching this shit. Right, they're just a pair of tits that you can fill up with blood, and that's really all that it means at the end of the day. And then what do you have? You have a movie where you don't really see. What do you even see? There's like one half of a murder on screen.
Yeah, I mean, Gregory gets pushed in the wall. The guy that gets pushed in, you know, from the into the train tracks from that upper part, I think, is the only murder we do see.
Yeah, and then maybe if you count Gregory getting stabbed.
This is honestly not
dead.
A violent
it's
movie.
Not a violent movie. There's almost no at blood all. And when you see dead bodies, you're not seeing the act of violence. And when you see, even when you see Mira's, it's just like lingering on like her form.
I mean, she's kind of like an art piece when we do, spoiler alert, find Mira at Club 99. She is essentially meant to be this sacrifice for this group, and she's in this room that's very ostentatious, and there's like artifacts around here, and the lighting's very centered on her, and she's covered and surrounded by lilies. Like, it's a really interesting looking, this is one of the interesting set pieces I really did like in this movie.
Yeah,
but she's this object of this peace and this beauty that's been taken over by this cult. It's super great. I mean, this is some of the stuff I really did enjoy about the movie, for sure.
Right, it becomes this thing where it's kind of showing that power, those power structures and what it's both within the genre itself as a meta commentary, but also in talking about like what this is a movie commenting about political power structures in the ruling class, and these are a couple of young beautiful bodies that are consumed for no reason other than to keep this system going. And so we are able to kind of view her as more, slightly more in that moment, as if she's being elevated beyond just this thing. But that's really all that her purpose ever was. And
yeah,
and in doing it outright, some people will call, I've read a very little about this movie after the fact, but I always do a little research, a lot of people saying this is like very anti-feminist, this is very sexist movie. And I honestly view it as the opposite. Even as someone that didn't really enjoy the movie, I'm viewing it very much so as a movie that pays much more reverence and is commenting about, like I said, that way that I keep using it, but I can't think of a different way to put it, because I think it's so apt, the way that horror films, especially giallo, really just consumed the female bodies. That's all that they existed for. They existed to be ogled and then destroyed, much like the reality of our world consumes the female form in all forms,
well,
but especially the female
form. Well, like, especially when we look at this cult, right? Like, in the big, like, scene where Gregory finds the cult, and, you know, that scene itself isn't anything spectacular. It's a lot of reds, it's a dark room, but it's this class of like legitimately like geriatric people just having an orgy. Like, you see a lot of nana titty in this scene, and it's kind of weird to say that okay, but because the way we're treating Mira isn't feminist, but we do have a lot of middle-aged women just bumping and grinding throughout this movie. I think it's because it doesn't show a pretty concept of femininity intelligently, because obviously, and we don't see that for any female character that's part of the cult specifically, but clearly there are women in this cult that are the reasons why they're in power all across the world. We know, obviously, in this whole scene, we get all the exposition, which is they're a cult of people that exist in the higher runs of society, no matter where you exist, that are controlling everything, you know, killing those who decide and choose to be killed.
Right. It's again, so you have your classic sort of shadow government type of story there. And it's exactly as you said. I mean, there are all these older people there, and they just, they do what they want to do to stay in power. They do what they must do to stay in power. It's very much so, it's very similar echoes to, you know, another film, which is Society. There's a lot of there's a lot of interplay there, slightly different tones, of course, and in the way the manner in which they take it, but it's not. This is neither a new concept then, nor was it the last time this concept was kind of explored. But insofar as that depiction, where you have a level of body horror in this, with besides the main body horror of being trapped in one's body, you know, having that locked in syndrome, you also have the body horror that comes with the way that Mira is presented, which is like as this sacrifice, like she's more beautiful than she's ever been. I think the janitor even's like, she's hot. Yeah. She's hot. What a fucker.
As he tries to beat Gregory with an extension cord or like a cord to his vacuum, it's like, no, get out of here, foreigner. And he's like whipping him. It's it's kind of the really weird scene, and it takes you out of the thriller part of it. Cause you're like, what the fuck are you doing, Jeeves? Like, calm down.
But it does kind of, even that has a body horror aspect. That has like almost like a Midsommar vibe of like,
yeah, like a flagellation almost.
Yeah. Like, well, and in the way that her body is presented, where it's, you know, she's more beautiful than she's ever been, but she's fucking dead. Jane, just, you know, at the whims of these people. But I think that there's a lot to this movie. And like I said before, I think if you were to read a novel about it, or to read the screenplay, or have this discussion, it sounds great. And there's a lot of things I liked about it, but I just found the overall pace to be kind of boring. I didn't find the color palette to be particularly interesting. Not that I want that technical color nonsense of like an Argento film, but there's not a huge amount of interesting shots, despite who the cinematographer is. There's a couple scenes that are composed very, very well, a couple interesting pieces of set dressing. The music very, very much so elevates it. Maybe I'd be able to take it more seriously and have a different opinion on it if I were able to watch it with subs and not dubbed. That could have been a problem, possibly. But I've watched a lot of Jolly. I usually can get over that. So for me, this movie ended up being a 2 out of 5. I'm willing to revisit it, and there's a lot of things I like. I definitely would recommend you watch it. I just, not quite for me.
It's totally fair. I think it's one of the few times you and me are going to disagree on something and be a little bit more gentlemanlike. I give it a 4 out of 5 for all the reasons that Steve did like the movie. One of the reasons why I do love this movie is that it is kind of brings to awareness this contemporary theme of the powers that be, but also like, I guess if you are, have been following the Epstein and Maxwell chicanery, it will kind of draw you in a little bit, because it does kind of show that this is not a flash in the pan thing that we've dealt with in the last 10 years, that obviously these opinions, and whether they're fact or fiction, and I would say in the Epstein and Maxwell case, there's very obviously something very fishy there.
Yes.
it does show that this is something that we have, you know, past generations and past filmmakers and creator types have thought about. I'm really glad we agreed on the Mira thing, because I do think think for a character as a set piece, she is important. I don't mind a Jiali with a bad dub because it does make the film more fun. I would have liked to see this actually with the original Italian voiceover work done. But it does have a lot of the elements for traditional Jiali that I do really like. And I think it is a good example of what the genre more traditionally is outside of Argento and the rest. So it's really enjoyable. You can watch it on Shudder. It will be that dubbed version. I am not sure if it is on Tubi. I know they've put some stuff up recently, but otherwise you can find the original version on Amazon or any other movie site. And I think it's like $8.99 to $10 for the Blu-ray of the actual traditional Italian dub on it. So if you really do like it, you can find it. We are going to do the New York Ripper next week, which will be super fun. I am very curious if Jenna is going to be able to sit through that entire movie. It's going to be very interesting. I think she will, just so she can have angry opinions. So that will be fun. Steve, where can we find you on the internet?
Find me on the Twitter, on the Letterboxd, on even the Spotify and the SoundCloud and the Twitch now at RudeSpeaker. I'm trying to get this Twitch stream going. Of course, once I set a schedule, I came down with COVID almost immediately. So, I'm hoping to get that going. Maybe the day that this episode comes out, I might stream. So watch out for that. If not, I'm definitely going to try to stream the next week. And I'm going to be shortly putting a version of our theme song a little bit longer and releasing that on Spotify and all other music platforms under the RudeSpeaker name. So please check out RudeSpeaker on Spotify, follow, so you can get updates for that. That if people didn't know, the name of our theme song, which has a name, it's not just the GLS theme song, is called Cartoon Dracula. So
awesome.
So remember that. And so if you like that, please check that out. And I'm hopefully going to be having some more music to come.
I did not even know that was the official name to our track, so that makes me, it endears it to me much more. If you want to find me, of course you want to do that. I am at Da Ghoul Daddy, D-A Ghoul Daddy, on the Instagrams and the Twitters. Obviously, if you follow me on Twitter, it's a lot of dark jokes and sports opinions, but I have had many of you follow me recently, and I do enjoy the little interactions we do have. Twitter is the best place to reach me. If you want to send something to the show, do so at groovylittlespookshow@gmail.com, which is groovylittlespookshow@gmail. The Patreon for the show is going to be coming out really soon. I actually, today, before this episode was recorded, I am doing one of the bonus things that we're going to be doing. It's called Schlocked and Loaded. It's basically a interview series that I'm going to do with independent musicians, artists, filmmakers, inside horror, outside horror. The first little series is going to be about a 6 or 7 episode arc that I'm doing with adult comic artist Barbatus. He does a comic called Sad Sack, which is, I would say, on the extreme exploitation end of the art style. As we talked about in the episode, it's pretty pornographic, but while we had these really interesting conversations getting to know him and talking about the art. So that's going to be the first series that does come out as a Patreon exclusive. So you will have to join up to be able to get access to that. And then additionally, me and Steve are going to twice a month put out an episode that we're going to at least call for now After Hours, where it's going to be another GLS-esque episode, but not horror. We'll talk about politics or movies or weird news stories. This is kind of a more traditional radio show-esque bonus thing that we're going to dick around with.
Yeah, you know, like that beginning of the episode where we're rambling and everyone hates it?
We're going to do that for a full hour. Yeah. So if you do join the Patreon, that information will be coming out real soon. It's going to be a real easy, flat price that we're going to keep low as we start up. That usually most podcasts do like $3 or $5. We'll be in that range. There will be a special tier that will get you a special GLS shirt courtesy of T Teespring, I think it is. So it's going to be a limited thing that we're going to do before we have more merch designed to sell. I have had people ask me, so that is coming. So it's going to be kind of a thing in progress. We're going to get used to Patreon. All of the regular episodes you're hearing now, the actual Groovy Little Spook Show, will always be free, always available on everywhere that we can have it for now. We don't have any reason to put a paywall over this because we know that people enjoy it so much. But we do want to offer big fans of the show some extra content, and it gives us a little creative flexibility to try some new things, which will be fun.
Yeah, so, and try to not to oversell and overhype this too much, but try to get in early, because as we grow the show, and we have been, the show's definitely grown, and we're making moves and stuff, especially with all the our Mutant Fam affiliation and everything. It's going to be growing, so if you get in early and get some of those, you might be getting some exclusive stuff that'll only be available in the early run of this. And as we grow and expand the tiers, we're kind of get you a little bit grandfathered in on stuff that comes later on. So get in on the ground floor, help us build this thing. You'll be a part of it. I mean, not to throw anyone under the bus in any sort of way or say information, no one, you know, or whatever, but it's like Barbados is one of our first fans, and now we're doing a fucking series with him. He's a really cool guy. He's a really talented guy, and we'd love to do that. So, I mean, not saying that, you know, DMing me is going to be the surefire way to get yourself on the podcast or whatever, but we want to interact with you guys. We want to build this stuff up. So getting in now, getting in the Discord, getting on the Patreon, listening to the episode, sharing the episodes. That's how we're going to build this all up.
Yeah. And like Steve said, it has been growing. It's kind of super cool for doing this for 9 months to see that we do have a fan base, which is fun. Like I don't want anyone to think it's an ego trip.
No, completely.
It's more nerve wracking than anything. But I've learned to still be the goofball Muppet that I am. But, as Steve said, obviously contact us if you're interested in that, and doing anything like that. If you are an independent artist, and as we release merch, we'd love to share your artwork as something, as part of maybe an exclusive t-shirt or hat we release, that we would obviously be more than happy to bring you in on a cut of too, because we want to get your art out there. That's a big thing for me, especially, is giving voice to a lot of independent artists, that aren't just podcasters or actors, but all the lot of, you know, you misfits that are out there. So we're super excited.
Be a cool thing to do, actually, not to cut you off, but maybe
I think
maybe doing a little competition where we'll get like make three or four shirts based off of fan designs, and we'll give you a cut.
Yeah, absolutely. And it gives Carl time off to actually do his actual job and not just making cool art for
this
us.
This is his actual job.
It really is, but keep that all in mind, guys. We're going to get out of here because I think me and Steve are both going to die from our related illnesses. Be back next week, New York Ripper. Hopefully Jenna joins us. Stay groovy.
Arrivederci.